Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Retail Refined, a Market Scale podcast with your host, me, Melissa Gonzalez. Today, I'm really excited for a differentiated conversation that we're going to have here at Retail Refined. With me in that conversation is Dan Miller, who is the founder and CEO of Steward. Dan is also the co-founder and former president and director of Fundraise, the largest real estate crowdfunding platform in the US, which raised over $4 billion from 400,000 investors since its inception. He brings his experience in finance, real estate, and technology, and his passion for agriculture to Steward, which is an online lending platform for regenerative agriculture. And we're going to learn a lot more about what regenerative agriculture, which obviously my mouth is having a hard time saying today, what that means in this segment. He brings that diverse background he has in finance, real estate, and technology, as I mentioned, with his passion for agriculture, but also a history stemming from his maternal family, which has been farming on the eastern shore of Maryland since the 1880s. And a lot has happened and changed since the 1880s. So we really want to talk about how he's bringing that forward-thinking mentality to the industry, how he's creating change with Steward. And I know that we're going to dive into a lot of things about how he's successfully funded nearly 90 regenerative farms, totaling over $30 million in financing so far. And he's just getting started. So Dan, thank you so much for being with me today.
Thanks for having me, Melissa.
Yeah, so I just gave, I feel like, the highest level introduction. So why don't you tell the audience a little bit more about you, what Steward is, and why you co-founded it?
Sure. Well, thanks for the background. There are a lot of pieces there, but they all tie in and they all are relevant. So my name's Dan Miller. I grew up in Washington, D.C. My mother's family were farmers from the Eastern Shore of Maryland. My father was in commercial real estate. So I brought kind of both of those histories back. Currently, I'm the CEO and founder of Steward. So Steward is a platform that raises capital online to fund regenerative farms. And what we mean by regenerative agriculture is agriculture that's focused on ecosystem health, focused on soil health, focused on nutrition for people, focused on fair wages, but really an integrated agricultural system that is different than the commodified kind of conventional system of agriculture. Mm-hmm. And so I learned really about regenerative agriculture and those types of producers that were focused first on soil and ecological health through a chef I met in Baltimore, growing up in the Washington, D.C. area. His name was Spike Jurdy. His restaurant is Woodbury Kitchen. So really well-known, award-winning chef around regional sourcing from the Chesapeake Bay watershed. And that's where I grew up. I grew up in Washington, D.C. My mom's from Eastern Shore, Maryland. My dad, Sammy, was from Baltimore. All of that was around the Chesapeake Bay watershed, the largest estuary in the United States. And the health of that ecosystem was deteriorating. And so I was always struggling with how can we have an agricultural system that would enhance the ecosystem, that would sustain it, versus what seems to be happening now, which is a system that's producing a lot of volume, but the rural communities that are producing it are struggling, and the ecology around it is struggling. And so I was always trying to find that alignment. And it was through this chef who was making value-added products from amazing regional specialties, was featured, you know, as a great farm-to-table, direct-source local restaurant. And so through him, I started not only hearing the story of these amazing heritage products from the region, but also tracing the supply chains from producer to really processor to restaurant to finished product. And in those conversations, even with the huge consumer demand and growth in people trying to buy from farmers markets and buy sustainably sourced agricultural products, the actual producers of those products did not have access to capital that they needed. Mm-hmm. And that was really the challenge that Steward was trying to solve, is how do we take that consumer demand for traceable, sustainable, identity preserved products and tie that with availability of financing for the producers growing and raising those products. And so that was the genesis of Steward and the idea of raising that money online from individuals that we aggregate and then provide as credit, as financing. So we're trying to take that pool of interested individuals who want to see mm-hmm. food systems change, and aside from just purchasing, are now using their capital to lend to these businesses, and then also a flexible values-driven funding for these agricultural producers and the supply chain. So we also fund value-added processing like a flour mill, all the way to finished end product. So it's about tracing from production, value add, CPG, whatever it is along the supply chain. How do we make it easier for people to source these products and make it easier for the businesses actually to fit into a system that they don't have to do all on their own?
It's so interesting. And you started to answer one of the questions I was about to ask you, because funding's great, obviously, and important. But what do you think are the biggest pain points, right? When you think about this ecosystem that has to be created, what are those, like, those biggest pain points? And then how are you able to help solve it by having this collective mentality?
So there is a real regional need. I think that's the first takeaway, that you're talking about watershed. What a watershed means is all the rivers and lakes and streams that drain into a certain area of water. And so in that ecosystem, in that climate, everything is connected. You know, what happens upstream impacts what's downstream. And often geographically, it's kind of within the region that can sustain itself. And so right now you have a situation where conventional ag and commodity ag has gotten to really a global scale where it's ignoring the regional level and it just focuses on huge, large scale, really national global infrastructure, which really doesn't serve anybody but the largest producers. So it really is a market where you've got a lot of commodified volume of the same product all blended together, all provided in a finished good, but there's really no differentiation or tie to place. And then you have the like grassroots, you know, movement of organic agriculture back to the land, which has built itself through farmers markets and other direct engagements, but hasn't quite gotten to the scale and viability to really dent, you know, large volumes of what's sourced in the country. And so a lot of what our work is doing is, how do we take those disparate regional networks of people on their own kind of fighting forward for healthier food and better access? And how do we start to provide the financing to integrate those systems? How do we get the producers in sync with the processing, such as mills, flour mills, livestock processing, in touch also with the CPG customers and end buyers? And how do they integrate that whole system where you can have a product grown, processed, packaged, and sold with full traceability all the way through, and the value sharing among all of those groups? So even though we began with kind of one-off funding of farms, a lot of our work now is at that regional level. How do we fund, you know, a $40 million regional flour mill that can buy from 40,000 acres of traceable wheat and mill it and sell it direct to consumers and bakers? And how do we keep the value within that system? And so the challenge is capital. There's no way you can do that without a lot of capital, equipment, land, infrastructure. But the funding in ag is really driven by the policy. And the policy drives large commodity production of a few staple corn, soy, you know, a few staple crops at fairly low prices. And so you have a structural issue where the policy incentivizes a certain outcome. The money follows that because it knows the government backstops it. And then anyone not in that system is really left on their own. So our goal is, how do we encourage growth among that alternative system? But let's also get it to a point where it can provide real volume. And to your audience around the retail and consumers, we work with a lot of CPG companies that are trying to source more regeneratively, or just trying to source, you know, from specific producers, unique varieties of things that they can then include in their product. And that's very hard for them to do. The processing's not there. The co-packing certainly isn't there. And so you have a lot of these infrastructural issues, which make it very hard for you, an individual business, to succeed. Yeah. And that's the challenge. Or you have a structural issue that each person is trying to solve themselves.
No, absolutely. There's so many things to that. I'm just jotting down notes so I can remember all the things I'm going to ask as you speak, because there's so much in what you answer. But I'm going to go back to the policy part. So coincidentally, I was watching this Netflix documentary last night about gut health. And when you think about regenerative, right, and you think of some of the things that you're facilitated, I think that so much of that is also tied to the more mass education that's happening around gut health and how we should eat. And when you talk about, you know, like working with more local farmers and the value of that, and what do you think there? Like, do you think as more of that education comes out and there's more and more awareness of it, does it have the impact, the opportunity to impact kind of how policies are approached?
The culture is the main driver. That's definitely the big gap. I think people have been disconnected from their food, how it's prepared, the real provenance of it. The idea of simple food versus a lot of the additives and things that are put in the system. So I think we're at a point now where the norm is very low. People's cultural understanding is limited. The heritage of grandparents and descendants is often gone. And so we are at a baseline, and agriculture, you know, has a culture of growing food and of the land. And I think the U.S. policy really drove towards consolidation and towards the kind of elimination of the number of farms to fewer farms that were bigger. But the knock-on effect there was then the local shops closed, the local service providers closed, and you just ended up with no products and no availability. And so we're at a very low point. I think chefs and certain influential food people have shown that there is a lot of interest and demand in food, in the provenance of food, in the storytelling around food, and that if people had more of a chance to buy it more simply, that they would be able to do it. The challenge is we're at such a low level right now. I believe the USDA number is 1% of food is grown, processed, and sold locally, which is about 325 miles is their definition. So a very large radius, almost nothing. Yeah. So we're still at the point where it's mainly claims, it's mainly people hoping for alternative, but structurally the capacity really isn't there. I do see a generational shift. You know, the younger someone is, the more they seem to be aware, cognizant of environmental impacts of food, environmental impacts of behavior. Unfortunately, there's a lot of misinformation about what actually is negative or positive impact. Livestock being a great example of whether or not you consume livestock. Livestock are part of any natural system. As the famous Sir Albert Howard, one of the original thinkers in agriculture, wrote that nature always farms with livestock. And so there's an idea there that there's a systematic integration needed, and there's an understanding of all of those components. But every day I would say I'm encouraged by the people entering the sector. About half of the 90 projects that we funded are from non-farm backgrounds. So you have a lot of people entering agriculture that didn't grow up in it, which is very rare. And then you also have, every day I get emails from people wanting to work in this sector. And so you're seeing people that, you know, went to MIT and could work at any of the top tech companies, hoping to work in regenerative agriculture. And so those are the indicators to me that real change is underway. But from the data, it's definitely a very small percent.
I agree. And I agree. It's definitely can be overwhelming. And this is one person perspective, but I'm always studying trends. I mean, even in my Instagram feed, the amount of information coming my way around gut health and, to your point, products, I think there's more of a desire, but it could feel confusing. And while 1% feels bleak, it's also a huge opportunity to leap off of. So you mentioned kind of, you know, this and the CPG industry. And so when we think of the big heavyweights like General Mills, Big Picture Foods, et cetera, how are you coming together with them? Like, how are the big heavyweights potentially kind of, because usually you see an opportunity of change when you have kind of a consortium, right, of those with that much influence helping change happen. Are we seeing that? Are you partnering with them? What's your outlook there?
Yeah, I personally am mainly ignoring them. That's just my opinion personally. Like, it really takes a deep personal commitment to this type of work. All of the producers we work with, all of the makers, you know, deeply committed from a values perspective to this type of work. And so I find most of the corporates that are trying to drive change, it's still a bit of a battle of, is it about economics? Is it about branding? What? And so those conversations end up being confused because there's not one person you're talking to has a belief and an answer. There's a lot of groups and divisions. So I think there is a lot of discussion among the huge multinationals about, they use the term regenerative agriculture even. There's a lot of discussions around it. But structurally, how they're built, which is to take all the margin in the middle and pay producers as little as possible and provide food for the best margin that is palatable for consumers, it's just structurally, I think, misaligned with the idea of distributed, diverse, regional systems. So I'm more of the view that we need to build a new model and prove the viability of that model. And then we can figure out how to make the big transition from the big established groups over. But we're now at the point where we're still trying to prove just the viability of regenerative agriculture. Can it produce and sell at a price that can sustain it? Because if the producers can't have a livelihood, then there's no conversation. So I tend to find the corporate interest is not as heartfelt. Often you'll have Danone as an example. A new CEO comes in, talks very excitedly about regenerative agriculture and paying farmers more and sourcing. And then 3 years later, some activist shareholder doesn't like it. They're gone. They're trying to jack up the stock price. So unfortunately, I think the work I'm seeing that I'm most inspired by are the like startup CPG companies and give some examples of them, but like young entrepreneurs really committed to changing the food system and diving in a very niche specific way around their product, but through that storytelling, opening up opportunities for new. And I know that the normal path for a lot of those businesses is a sale to one of those conglomerates. So I think that's
Yes.
challenge is that
Yeah.
success means you're selling to a conglomerate, which often means the company's growth and values change or shift.
Sure.
And so how do we create permanence? How do we create permanent independence in agriculture? And that's a lot of what I'm thinking about, of not just like the solving of the product, but the structural change around power and influence and control. And so that always puts me with the underdogs.
Yeah, no, I love that. It's a mix for sure, because often those bigger conglomerates, they have so much infrastructure and so much corporate layers that they do have to rely on the more nimble, innovative startups that are going to be at the cutting edge, and then they try to bring them in. But economics do matter too. So as you're working closely, one of the stats that you guys shared were that some of your studies indicate that regenerative farming practices actually increase nutrient density in crops by 15 to 30% compared to conventional methods. To me, I read that as there's one opportunity right there, right? If you continue to lean into things like that, where the math starts to prove out, you know, then you can get more believers and create change. So can you talk to us a little bit about that and some of the other findings you're seeing?
Absolutely. I think that's the key that I've learned throughout all of this, that good agricultural practices, good stewardship of the land and soil, focusing on soil health and ecological health leads to a great end product. And I think that's what our bodies know, right? When something is delicious, there are certain flavors and your body adjusts to basically the nutrition density. Yes, we need to measure it through spectrometers, but there's something in a person and just that you can understand when you're consuming it. And so the key is, how do we make them great products that people want, but also have all of the benefits of being healthy and nutritious? And a lot of that revolves around the agricultural practices. So I was just in the Midwest, thousands and thousands in Iowa and Minnesota, thousands of acres of just corn, soy rotation, no cover crop, just bare soil most of the year, other than when they've planted the cash crop. And we're working with a farmer there who's adding oats to that rotation to get more diversification. He's requiring the growers in his regional oat network to use cover crops. And we're even working with other growers who have even a 15 crop rotation. So one piece of land, they'll rotate 15 different crops through until they cycle back. What that does is provide reduced pressure from insects. It provides natural fertility across those products, reduces the need for any inputs. And so what you found is, like, good ecological practices improve the bottom line for the farmers because there's less need for inputs and there's a net better quality product at the end of the day. But the challenge most of these producers have is markets, right? They can grow whatever most of the time. Production isn't the challenge, but now they've got 800 acres of product. Where's it going to go? They can't just spec that much volume. They have to harvest it. They have to store it. They have to do all of this cost. So that's where the policy system comes in. You have policy that drives the money to corn and soy. Anything that isn't corn and soy for those growers means they're in their own system where they have to figure out a buyer. They have to figure out the processing. They have to go beyond just dropping the crop at a silo. And so that's the type of structural element we're trying to change, is prove that this type of agriculture can work outside of a policy system. Instead of fighting for government subsidy versus the other big crops, let's just show that you can have economic viability outside of that system. And then we can have a discussion around how to broaden the system. But we have a real challenge where the incentives push producers towards the wrong outcome, and the right outcome, which is more diverse crop rotations, more varieties of things, also requires more infrastructure, more markets, and all of the other things that don't exist. But the key thing is great agricultural practices, really good processing and handling of the product to finished good is the best version of a product you can have. And the benefit to agriculture around re-regionalizing versus a lot of other sectors is the product is generally best closest to the source. So it really makes sense to have something within a few hundred miles versus thousands of miles. Flour is an example. The reason why it's sifted and they've taken all the bran and the germ and nutritional value out of it is because of shelf life. They want it to sit for 2 and 3 years. And that's built around those supply chains where stuff's getting shipped forever around. So they've changed the product quality and nutritional content just for shelf stability around a long supply chain that doesn't even need to exist if you have a better supply chain. So I see these kind of trade-offs all the time where they don't make very much sense, but they exist just in the system we have. But when you can have that traceable product across a few hundred miles with a beautiful milling process that creates a wonderful flour with blended bran and the germ, but also partially sifted so that it has the baking qualities for bakers, you then have a product that people want. It's a better product. It's got a better story. It comes from a place they can identify. And that's what excites me. The consumer interest has changed. People want to find those products and opportunities.
I definitely think interest has changed, not just for me watching that documentary, because I've been studying for a while, but the more curiosity and awareness around gut health. So many videos going around about the number of things that are actually allowed and sold in our country that are literally banned in countries across the world, right? Our practices. And then, but yes, I agree. I think consumer interest, because social media has helped with that. It's just so much more in your face now and people wanting to stand behind it. But again, economics are the kind of the barrier there, because, you know, they're going to go to what they care about it, but they're going to prioritize other things or what they can afford. But it's great to see that, oh, the other thing was allergies. Like, even think about how awful allergies have become, and pollen and all of that. And our us not eating local is also not getting our body to become more immune, right, to the things around us that's aggravating the system. So I think those are just all things that people are coming more and more aware of. So if somebody is looking to be part of your platform, see if they qualified for a Stewart loan, what are some of the things that you're qualifiers that you have? What are some of the questions that you're asking?
Sure. So at the end of the day, our business provides credit. We loan money to agricultural businesses. Most applicants are referrals, word of mouth, you know, no other producers we worked with. They'll submit a loan application. We'll underwrite the loan from a financial perspective, also from an agricultural perspective. Often we work with them through business planning a bit and capital needs and what we fund first or not. I think a key aspect of the producers and companies we work with are, you know, values driven. They're committed to a product, committed to a place, committed to building a system that's more equitable. They're very entrepreneurial. Once you're outside the policy supports of ag, you're really on your own, and it's a very free market, and you need to figure out what needs to happen, and things change and consumer contracts change and customers change. So really adaptive around knowing that things will change throughout the overall enterprise. And then we'd like to focus on businesses that are integrating, like I said, integrated crop rotations that have value-added products that are focused on, you know, production of higher margin products. I think a lot of agricultural businesses, producers chase volume. They want more contracts. They want to produce more, but volume means you have to move it. And then that makes you more beholden to the system. So focusing on higher quality, higher margin, more direct sales, value-added processing goes a long way. Specific to some of the CPG companies we work with, one of the ones I really have enjoyed working with is called Lil Bucks. They make sprouted buckwheat. And so they source their buckwheat from a regenerative organic certified farm in Minnesota. This is the farm I mentioned that has 15 crops in the rotation, which is just amazing. One of those is buckwheat, which is not a wheat, but a seed, but that's another conversation. And so they then purchase the buckwheat and they sprout it. And then they sell this as part of like a granola kind of topping, health food topping. So delicious, very good for soil health, and good product demand. So we provided a $400,000 loan to them for their purchases of buckwheat. Previously, they were having to use cash, operational money to fund the inventory purchases, which is just a nightmare from an operational perspective. You know, you need that money for salary, for payroll, and now it's stuck in buckwheat. Yeah. And so we were able to finance the buckwheat purchases. And for us, that ties directly to our theme, which is we want to trace it to the agricultural producer. We want to support direct measurable supply chains. And so even though we weren't funding a farmer, we were funding a business to enable them to buy more products from the producer to then establish their viability. So that was a good example of us helping to just between two parties who want to work together, but working capital and financing was a challenge that we were able to step in. And so that loan will probably double every year. Started out as 400,000. This year, we'll do another loan around harvest in October. That'll be about 1 million. And so we've now built this like revolving annual purchasing cycle so they can buy all the product at harvest and then sell it throughout the year. Because when you're buying identity preserved specialty products, you can't just buy it on spot market. You can't just order it whenever. And so we're trying to set up systems that align around those natural cycles.
I love that. Well, that organically answers a question I was going to ask you. So twofold. One, kind of short term, where do you see kind of the lower hanging fruit opportunities, change that you think you can make in the next year or so? And then down the road, what excites you 5 years from now?
Yeah, absolutely. So short term, I think just like that deal I mentioned, inventory financing, equipment financing, we just, Karen Spring Mills, who I've mentioned a few times, stone milled flour. We just helped fund a palletizer for them. So that's just, again, labor saving, efficiency. Mm-hmm. So those types of inventory purchases, equipment, we're doing those all the time, you know, helps the company run better, helps margins, more product in the market. Those are quick and very straightforward. And each one of them, you know, encourages more growth with those businesses. The long term, I really see around that regionally integrated networks. That's the real gap. Mm-hmm. Anywhere I've come across, you've got, you know, great producer group and some infrastructure and some buyers, but even then it's not at the kind of integration and scale that it's needed to get price point down and to have more commercial viability. And so a lot of these projects, and we're working on flour mill, livestock processing, even fisheries, salmon, all of this, how do we have traceable supply through processing through to end market at a volume that producers can supply and then that wholesale buyers can purchase? Because that's a big issue for a lot of wholesale buyers, is one operation is not reliable enough to supply the contract. Mm-hmm. And my hope is these regional kind of networks around processing would build that marketplace for buyers and sellers of the product to really start to move real volumes to get beyond that, you know, sub 1%. And so it's, mm-hmm. it's a bit unfair, I think, that regional agriculture gets considered to be non-economic, but it's more of the other way around, that the global commodity system has been provided with so much capital and ignored costs. Like you mentioned, the health issues, right? Those, they don't have to pay for those costs, even though they're creating those costs. So when you net look at the overall system, this type of agriculture that's resilient, that doesn't require external inputs, that keeps the value within these regions, there's no way it's not the preferred and better ecological and economic method. We're just dealing with an entrenched model that is very powerful and very established, which is why I think in decades for this business, that it's not possible to transform that agricultural sector in a few years. And I think that counters a bit to a lot of the climate concern of, like, it's, we're running out of time. It has to happen right now. And I know it does have to happen very quickly, but there's also 150 years of this type of regional global consolidation happening. So unwinding that, building more regionalized models, more equitable models with producers and consumers, it's going to take time. Even building one of these facilities takes 3 to 5 years. Yeah. And that's just one project.
No, absolutely. But it's an exciting road ahead. And you're already making so much change with where Stuart's at today. And I love that example that now, you know, you kind of have this new partnership in the system. So next year you can invest more because you're really helping bring the infrastructure together to allow for that growth. So thank you so much for taking the time with me today. I think that it's really exciting, to your point. We're at such early innings when it comes to consumer adoption, but then also the policies being there to be able to make change happen. But I'm going to continue to watch because I do think it's exciting, and I do think that there's more awareness and interest in it. So if the ecosystem can change, you know, it's kind of not too dissimilar if you think of, like, solar power back in the day, and everybody mm-hmm. talked about that, but the policies didn't support it, and so the economics weren't there. But making it more attainable, I think, is really what has to happen. So appreciate all that you're doing at Steward and the differentiation that you're creating. How can people continue to follow you after this episode?
Anyone can send me an email if they want, dan@gosteward.com. I'm always happy to reply. And they can go to our website, gosteward.com, and they can lend money to projects. They can support these businesses. Most of our loans are around prime, so people are earning, you know, 8 to 9% on loans. And that's the trade-off for off of how do people earn a economic return that they're happy with and also have values imparted within that. And I think that's the model that we've uniquely built by engaging individuals, which is, where's that balance? The world right now is pure economic, you know, just return-driven private equity or charitable foundations where they're giving away money. And those are generally the only two buckets available. But most people don't think in that way. You know, their minds are more blended around values and return. And so we've tried to build that market of, you know, where's that middle ground that return matters, but values also matter and output matters. And we've been amazed at this, the interest and the scale of funding and the speed of funding and just how many people out there are interested in that work. So yeah, anybody can create an account, fund a loan for as little as $100 and join the movement.
I love that. All right, Dan. Well, thank you so much for spending the time with us today. Again, this is Dan Miller. He is co-founder and CEO of Steward. You can continue to follow him. Go to gostuart.com, learn more. And we're going to continue to watch you, Dan, and see all the things that you can continue to change in the world. So thank you so much.
Thanks, Melissa.